Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Stack. Those of you on CommanderCast.com, I'm not pulling out of my driveway, and no one knows who I am, but I think we all know that that doesn't mean anything. I'm Aaron, a.k.a. Uncle Landrops, and I'm stuttering over my words, and this is my co-host, Eric, a.k.a. Grandpa Growth. So that was probably the worst intro I've done ever.
Do you want to just do that again?
Absolutely not. On CommanderCast.com. I'm Aaron, a.k.a. Uncle Landrops. With me is Eric, a.k.a. Grandpa Groat, and this is The Stack. How you doing, Gramps?
Doing real well. I'm actually very excited for our conversation tonight. I've got my whole bottle of wine to myself, and we're going to get into some pretty sweet deck lists in this episode. We haven't talked about deck lists very much so far, but
yeah, for sure.
We're doing it. Commander deck lists.
Yeah, so just so you know, guys, just quick rundown of the show. Tonight we're going to be talking about a cool budget format variant of Commander that I'm actually starting to play up here in Seattle, and it's called 2DH. And it's pretty simple. The rules are you use median prices on TCG Player. And everything under $2 is format legal. And so far, it's picking up quite a bit of steam since I moved up here. There's a lot of 1v1 action going on now, and tonight we're going to be talking about a deck that I'm going to be playing, and I'm going to get some tips from Gramps on how to make it better, if possible, so that I can help steamroll some of the better part of the metagame. And so that's going to be a big part of the show. I've actually got one or two decks that we can take a look at there, and we've got a really sweet article that Gramps found. It's Luis Scott Vargas, one of our favorite players of all time. And he's going to be running back this Lantern Control deck that is super rogue and super fun, and almost kind of like a mad scientist commander deck, which is, I think, something that appeals to Gramps and I, appeals to our senses. So there's that. But first, we need to run back some Robo Rosewater action. So for those of you guys who don't remember, Robo Rosewater is a Twitter thing, a Twitter feed that these people have come up with. They have an AI, and they have decided to print and feed it this AI magic cards and see what it comes up with. So our first card, you want to kick that one off for us?
The first Robo Rosewater card that I want to talk about is actually the most recent, I believe, at the time I'm reading this, is Azanz Affini. It is Azzanz-Affini. That, I mean,
awesome.
You pronounce it how you want. I did my best. But this is a creature of type horror. It is a 6/6 for 4 and 2 black, and it has Exalted, which amazingly is a real functional card. I don't know. It's not legendary. I don't know what Azanz Affini is, but it could be construed as a unique name. But overall, this card is pretty functional. This could show up in a real set.
I think it's very interesting if you read the reminder text.
Yes. Well,
so, let's get
the
there
funny
first.
Part. Yeah.
Whenever it says Exalted, and then it has the reminder text of whenever a creature you control enters the battlefield under your control, if you control a forest and deals combat damage to a player, if it was kicked, you may have it deal 2 damage to each creature without flying. So clearly this is not what Exalted does.
Yeah, but in my mind, it's still legit because reminder text is not actually part of the card.
Yeah.
So if we just evaluated the Oracle reading of this card, it is perfect. But it's hilarious that this, expert program that they've, this real crack shot piece of software they've designed to analyze cards, it doesn't know the difference between rules text and reminder text. And that's, obviously, they're not putting that into the program because that's sort of cheating, but that's a very easy distinction. In Magic rules, templating, anything that's inside parentheses doesn't matter. It's just there for your help and your benefit for newer players, people who've never seen mechanics or the cards before. But this is definitely not what Exalted does. And this is definitely a pretty wonky, whenever a creature you control enters the battlefield under control, if you control a forest and deals combat damage to a player, so you somehow need to rig up your Rude Goldberg machine so that a forest entering the battlefield under control, entering the battlefield under control that you also control a forest, if that land deals damage, and it was kicked, you may have it deal 2 more damage, presumably, to each creature without flying. So, like, still possible, but just crazy, batshit crazy.
Reminding us all that Exalted truly is a baffling mechanic.
Yeah, it's really... And some of the comments on this card obviously are hilarious. One of my favorites, this guy's just like, judge!
Yeah, I see that. I see that. Yeah. Guess Noble Hierarch was better than we thought. Maybe. Or something.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy that. You wanted to talk about... So today, I guess, on Twitter, it was on the Robo Rosewater Twitter feed. It actually says the different art in the artwork. So if you're following this on Twitter, obviously, and I highly recommend that you do, different art indicates the neural networks of differing quote-unquote intelligence. So newer computers mean cards with longer training and better input. So essentially what that means for us is you're able to tell now they have multiple systems. So you'll see which computers are doing what and how well they're doing it, which I find very fascinating too.
Yeah. And this card we were just discussing appears to be like 1950s or 1960s era computing. Like it's still got, it's almost like a telephone router, you know, when we used to have switchboards and an actual human connecting wires to different ports. That's a little bit what it looks like. You know, it's one of these gigantic room-sized computers. Whereas the next card we're going to get into, which a little bit more functional and uses the updated software, I guess we'll call it, for lack of a better name.
Yeah. This one's called Mercodos the Snape. Mercodos. Mercodos the Snape. It's a double green legendary creature spirit it's a 2/2. You pay 2 and a green and you tap it to untap target permanent. So this is something that I think is actually just bonkers crazy. Probably a little too powerful because of the Gaia's Cradle that's in the mono green deck.
Well, I mean, 3 mana and tapping a fragile creature. I guess I don't think this card is broken. I think this card is playable actually in real Magic under the right circumstances, which is something you can't really say for most of the Robo Rosewater cards. But what surprises me the most, again, this card was designed using the better, more intelligent software. But it has legendary creature spirit, and it has the templating in the name of name, comma, subtext. You know, which is typically one of like 2 methods they use for naming legendary creatures. So this software that they've used to design this card actually has been able to pick up on that nuance that, okay, here's the way that they're naming certain types of creatures, and all those creatures tend to be legendary. And that's really cool that it, you know, it has learned that, whereas the dumbed down iteration of the software is like, oh, this is in parentheses, must be rules text. Let's alter the rules text. So you get to see sort of the differences in the sophistication of each different piece of software and how it designs, and you know how that ultimately influences the results on the cards. And this is a pretty sweet one. This would this might even have its own commander deck if it were real.
I mean, that's I really do believe that it would have its own commander deck. And I also my biggest question here on this whole card: why do you think it chose Spirit? I mean, not that this matters, but if it did, why would they choose Spirit?
Well, first of all, there's a great deal of legendary spirits. I think if you added up all of the, you know, legendary creatures of each creature type, Spirit has got to be in the top 5. I'm just going straight off the cuff here. I don't know the actual numbers, but that's my raw assumption. There's plenty of them. So you think it was a ratio thing? Well, yeah, I'm going to say if it just chose randomly, there's like maybe a 1 in 10 chance or like a 1 in 15 chance that, well, we're making a legendary creature and we have to slap on a creature type. Well, we chose Spirit because that's the thing that seems to pop up a lot.
So do you like, okay, so 2-part question. 1, do you think Mercodos the Snape is a spirit? And if he wasn't a spirit, what creature type would you change him to?
Well, wizard. Obviously, I would change his type to wizard.
Because of the Snape. Because he's the Snape.
Because of, I mean, if Snape, obviously in reference to the Harry Potter character, if Snape were somehow created like as an inherited title, like in honor of Severus Snape, we now will say all potions teachers are the Snape.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the thing. Maybe he's the future. But that wouldn't necessarily fit with the, you know, the mechanics of the card, and I would like for the flavor and the mechanics to mesh. That usually produces better Magic cards, in my opinion.
Well, a Fetto Alchemist is a wizard, right? I mean...
Is a Fetto... Well, that also is a flavor. Shouldn't he just be an alchemist? Are all the alchemists wizards?
I'm pretty sure they're not alchemists.
Well, they should be.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it is what it is. They had the great creature typing. I'm pretty sure would have ruled them out anyway, even if they were creature type.
Yeah, you're right. He is a human wizard, the Effetto Alchemist. So I guess yeah, that pretty much brings the connection all the way back around. We've got you can have a spirit wizard. Is that too strange? I mean,
I would like elf wizard, I think, because just simply because it's green, I feel like an elf would do this. I feel like wizard also does this. Also, it kind of gets that thing back to green or to the blue, to blueness of it. I don't know. That was my thought.
Yeah. There actually were some comments on this card also that, you know, we're referencing Kiora's follower, or, you know, one person said that, like, this isn't, like, appropriate for the color pie. Which just signals to me immediately that person hasn't been playing Magic that long, because untapping things was green long before it became blue.
And long before it was cool to untap things.
Yeah, I guess. But, you know, the Kiora's follower, one of the other cards that's mentioned in the comments and sort of the most recent example we have of this mechanic of tap to untap target permanent, is both green and blue. And it's very appropriate in a lot of people's minds because untapping of permanents is both green and blue, yes, insofar as the history of the color pie as of today. So I think that this card is generally appropriate. I don't know if spirit is the most appropriate creature type, but creature type tends to depend more on the flavor of the set and the story of the set. He's a legendary creature, so we know he's a character that appears in whatever world we're visiting in this particular Magic set. So if spirits are appropriate there, then this card works. If you know, he's the one spirit in the Guild of Green Wizards or whatever, that wouldn't make quite as much sense.
Yeah, I mean, I could definitely see this being on like a, maybe like a, you know, maybe on Theros as like a spirit and, you know, somewhere trapped in the woods, maybe. I could see this just based on the name. Mercodos sounds like a Greek name. That's where I was going with that. Kamigawa, you know, you'd have to change the name though. I think the best way to attack this though is that spirit creature typing, and you know, that's the thing that you would have to change the most if you were going to do this. That and probably add flavor text to give it a cool story, because this card seems, I like it a lot. I, you know, in case you guys haven't figured this out, I'm just going to tell you, I like it a lot. I wish it had flavor text. I feel like that would be really awesome. Maybe that's the advanced, you know, super future computer that they're going to have for Robo Rosewater.
Oh boy, that's like season two kind of twist.
Yeah,
I don't see that ever working out too well. But
oh, but I would love it.
Actually, I take that back. A computer system can do this, and they've been arbitrarily limiting the information that they put into the system to help it design cards. If they gave it, I think, you know, an arbitrary amount of time and the complete set of all Magic cards, it would just purely design functional Magic cards that are appropriate under the current rules.
Yeah.
Now, you'd have to leave off certain portions of cards designed in the past that don't, you know, fit modern conventions for templating or modern color pie appropriation standards. But you can give it a set of cards where it would do this pretty much 100% of the time. Last thing I want to point out that you said, that this would be, it sounds like a Therosy name or like a Greek-ish name. Mm-hmm. So it's Mercodos.
Oh, yeah.
Which, interesting to me that there's not really like C in the Greek alphabet.
So it'd be a K.
It would be a K if it were Greek, but it could be in Roman, you know, the Latin alphabet. C has the ka sound, like Caesar, and there really is no K. So maybe this is just purporting that in the future we'll have a Roman-themed set. I'd be down with that.
Yeah. I mean, all I want is for Wizards, like one of these people. I don't know if they're even allowed to look at these things, or at least I don't think that Mark Rosewater is allowed from what I've been told. I don't know what the deal is with that, but it would be a shame. Anyway, if one of the people in Wizards just gets a hold of one of these cards and throws it into the set, and designs it, you know, just twists it to be really, you know, super BA, I think that would be awesome. There's a history of Magic being done that way. You know, Double Strike is a mechanic that was invented by somebody that was messing around with Magic cards. You know, the last Magic 2015 set, we had several people designing cards, including, you know, Penny Arcade and the person who made Zombies versus whatever, Plants or whatever.
Plants for Zombies.
Yeah, whatever that silly game was.
A lot of people liked it. Apparently neither one of us did.
Yeah, I mean, Phytotitan was was cool. I have no, they designed an okay Magic card. I'll give them that. So yeah, I would love to see some Robo Rosewater stuff. Maybe not even just, I don't think one would be enough for me though. I would want to see like five cards so that they knew, like that they made sure that we knew what was going on.
Just, well, they could just do the same thing that was done in M15, where they can put in the flavor text, you know, designed by Robo Rosewater.
Yeah.
And I think that would be cool. Yeah. I don't think that there's any good reason for them to do that, but I do definitely agree with you on the point that many cards designed by what we would normally think of as amateur designers or just fans of the game have made their way into Magic in the past, particularly from the great designer search, which they do apparently at their whim when they need to, you know, hire a new designer and they don't feel like they have adequate talent inside the organization. This has been done twice, and so far, virtually all of the people have actually had some influence in design. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily all get hired immediately. That's only just like they're competing for an internship. But all of them have had some subsequent connection to the design department, and many have influenced individual cards. Some mechanics that were presented during the Great Designer Search challenges have actually gone on to become real mechanics, whether in their original form or somewhat modified.
Yeah.
But you're definitely right. It happens.
So I would like to see Murkoto's the Snape. So if you guys listen to this, if you guys are out there calling all Wizards of the Coast Autobots, Murkoto's the Snape. Just make it for me, please. All right. Let's move on to our next topic, which is LSV's article about Zach Elsick, Lantern Control. Take it away, Gramps.
So this man has somehow top 16 a Grand Prix and then won a second Grand Prix, as I understand it, immediately thereafter with what looks like the biggest, most steamiest pile of cardboard that you ever could see in Modern. But this deck is real. It was profiled on like a daily deck or in top deck articles on the Mothership by Luis Scott Vargas, and LSV has subsequently posted a video on Channel Fireball of him playing the deck in a Modern queue. This deck is pretty sweet. It's called Lantern Control, and it revolves around the card Lantern of Insight, which is a one-mana artifact. It's an uncommon from Fifth Dawn, I believe. Each player plays with the top card of his or her library revealed, and you can tap and sacrifice Lantern of Insight to have target player shuffle his or her library. Now, the point of this is that you get to see what each player is drawing, and you can selectively influence when your opponents will draw relevant cards. They combine this with Codex Shredder and Ghoulcaller's Bell to create a sort of lock, so that after you have these pieces in play, your opponent will never be able to draw anything relevant. And they protect themselves with Ensnaring Bridge, which I have long thought, like, why don't people ever play this card? Like, this card used to get played in Legacy, should still get played in Legacy. If you're being beaten down by Tarmogoyfs or Nimble Mongoose or, you know, Delver of Secrets, just like, this card stops all those things. This card is crazy and really, in my opinion, should not be in Modern. Like, I feel like it's kind of unfair card that doesn't really belong in the Modern card environment. Wizards has moved away from potentially abusive stuff like this, but it's really powerful and it should get played in Modern because it is legal. So they basically play Ensnaring Bridge. You can't ever attack because it's very easy to dump your hand in this deck. There's basically nothing that costs more than three. And you just mill them while selecting for them only to draw irrelevant cards or lands. You know, it's pretty efficient, surprisingly.
Yeah, so let's talk about a couple of points that you ran down. So number one, I think that this deck is far away from being like a steamy pile. It is a bunch. It looks seemingly like a bunch of cards on the face. We've got
It looks that way. Yeah. It is not. It's real, but it looks crazy.
It's okay. So let's talk about the real cards. I'm just gonna pull them out and list them. We got three Spellskite. We've got four Inquisition of Kozilek. We've got two Thoughtseize. We've got two Abrupt Decay. We've got the Ensnaring Bridge, and that's about it.
Yeah. There's some like weird one-off cards that I think are worth talking about.
I was just talking about the hits. Like these are cards that are real. You know,
the Pyrite Spell Bombs actually are pretty relevant.
They're very
good because you need a way to instantly draw a card. Sometimes, let's say like you and your opponent both have a relevant card on top, but you can't. You don't want to like use your Ghoulcaller's Bell and mill both those cards because you want to keep your good card. So in addition to being able to kill early attackers and protect you, Pirate Spellbomb allows you to be able to selectively draw relevant cards and still deny those same cards to your opponent. Surgical Extraction is terrible, in my opinion. You know, it's just one of the silliest cards, but like gets played all the time. But in this deck, it is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's basically so free. You know,
so good.
There's many decks that require particular combinations of cards in Modern to be effective. You have Living End without the eponymous card, it's useless. You have Splinter Twin without the eponymous card, it's useless. You know, there's so many decks that just like hinge on their ability to resolve a single card. And without that, they're much less effective. If you manage to mill one of those cards, which it's easy to do because you know when they're going to draw it, and your whole game plan is to mill them out, well, Surgical Extraction essentially says you can go ahead and scoop up your cards now because we know I'm going to win, whether it's now or 20 minutes from now. You like your deck no longer functions.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm very excited. I mean, when I pulled out the best cards, I didn't put Surgical Extraction there because of like exactly what you said. It's not as good, and it's still being played, but it's, in my opinion, I agree with you. It's not as good as what you should be playing. But in this deck, it is a house. I think that there's a category of cards here that are probably powered up by this system. I dare say it, Gyarapur Aether Grid.
Yeah. The one-off, unpronounceable flavor name, Aether Grid.
Yeah.
Gyarapur, terribly named card from Magic Origins, a new addition, I guess, to the deck.
Yeah.
LSV explains a little bit about the inclusion of this card in his video series. It still seems pretty wonky to me, but in many games, you end up with five or six artifacts in play, and it ends up being a way that you can kill creatures if they manage to destroy your ensnaring bridge or you never find an ensnaring bridge. It's a way that you can accelerate the end of a game. Stealing four or five damage, you know, I guess three or four damage realistically, is a lot faster than milling them for three cards a turn.
Yep.
And a lot of these things like, you know, the Lanterns of Insight, the Mox Opals if you don't need them for mana, the Pithing Needles, the Spell Bombs, the Ensnaring Bridge itself, like these, you don't actually have to tap these things for their abilities most of the time.
Yeah.
So you can use them instead to just start shooting down creatures and clearing the board.
Yeah. So other thing I'm thinking about here, Gyarapur Aether Grid, pretty good against the matchups where you try to board in Kitaki, because this is something that people were playing against Affinity, right? But against this deck, you can't do jack crap against. You can't Kitaki unless they just straight up don't draw into Pirate Spellbomb or Aether Grid, which seems pretty unlikely. You know, it's not like you even care. You also have Abrupt Decay to beat up the Kitaki if you need it, or just to get it out of their hand right away. What is the jankiest card in your mind in this deck? Because to me, it's Ancient Stirrings, just straight up.
The jankiest card to me?
Yeah. In this
by
deck.
Jankiest, you mean like doesn't belong? Or just like...
Just like the worst, probably like the objectively worst, or maybe even doesn't belong? Yeah.
Well, I think the objectively worst card is Surgical Extraction. But the card to me that doesn't belong is Abrupt Decay.
Okay.
We already talked about Surgical Extraction, and in 99% of decks, it's garbage and people play it way too much. But Abrupt Decay in this particular deck, I don't understand it. You know, we just talked through Aether Grid and its potential uses against Kitaki, which is extremely important. This deck really can't beat a Kitaki because it has very few mana sources. It's 21, including a Mox Opal. And, you know, one of those is a Tendo Ice Bridge. Four of those are Glimmer Voids. So, like, if Kitaki causes you to lose all your artifacts, you will subsequently lose your Glimmer Voids. The Mox Opal isn't always on if you lose your artifacts. So, like, Kitaki creates serious problems. Now, Abrupt Decay does kill Kitaki, but it does so for two different colors of mana. So, like, three is the high end of mana. You see, nothing in this deck really costs three except the Gyarapur Aether Grid. That's the one card. You know, two mana of two different colors is actually kind of a challenge in this deck. You don't always have two lands that can both produce colors at will. Glimmer Void really is the nuts in this deck. Like, Glimmer Void it pulls this deck together. Mm-hmm. But like I said before, they're playing a Tendo Ice Bridge because their mana isn't perfect. You know, they need a five color land that doesn't deal them damage, that comes into play untapped. So they have things, you know, like they've got single forest, which presumably will help them somehow if they have to Ghost Quarter themselves. I just don't really get it. But yeah, I feel like Abrupt Decay is a little bit challenging to cast.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I think I would want to. I would never leave home without mine if I'm playing modern, I guess. That's the way I feel. And like even two in here, that seemed pretty normal to me. I keep laughing at Gear per Aether Grid. I don't know if people know what this is at home. So Gear per Aether Grid, I'm just going to read it off. It's a two and a red enchantment. Tap two untapped artifacts you control. Gear per Aether Grid deals one damage to target creature or player. So this is what we're talking about when we have, alternate win conditions. So he can beat you with 20 life if he draws into his one of Aether Grid, or he can just mill you out, and let the games go. The one thing I wanted to mention before the show, I was telling Eric here, I really like this deck is something that I feel is somewhat, it's not totally reminiscent at all, really, to, he was playing, Eric was playing a Salvaging Station 60 card deck. It had some cool, Mirrodin stuff, and it had the Jitte and a Salvaging Station to go get back all of his Spellbomb stuff. So in my mind, it's a little similar to that. Like, you're trying to lock people out with stuff. You're trying to abuse, removal spells and things like that to get value. And just to create sort of an artifactory, if you will, of combo. Do you feel like it's similar in a different way? I mean, are you getting what I'm saying?
I absolutely am, and it's similar not in the mechanical perspective, but it's similar in that it hits all the same like things that make me excited. Like we have a huge board of permanents, very few things in hand, but all these things, all these little pieces, much like eggs, a different modern deck, all these little pieces just work together in different ways, and it's very sophisticated. And if you've never seen this deck before, you really do not know what is going on. Like, you have to have done your homework to even realize which cards are important to the strategy and which are just like, oh, he's got Ancient Stirrings. Do I counter Ancient Stirrings? And he's be like, oh, whatever, I don't care. Like, someone has three Lanterns of Insight in play, and you're just like, what am I doing? Like, I thought this was a tournament, like there's money on the line. Like, you had to buy a plane ticket to come here. Like, it's just, I'm sure that this deck drew some interesting looks from opponents during the early rounds, and I would love to be in that position.
Yeah.
Pretty much more than anything else in Magic, if I can just have my opponents not understand what I'm getting at, that makes me feel pretty good.
Yeah. I remember one time I was playing an FNM, and it was back in Zendikar, and there was somebody that was playing Allies, and I'm playing Mono Black Vampires. So, like, basically, turn four, if I have Vampire Nocturnus, the game was over. And, like, this guy, his deck was so slow, I didn't really understand what he was doing. And, this is a much more effective deck than the Ally deck. But, even me not understanding what he was trying to do, and even knowing all the cards, it was definitely some pressure and a challenge, because I was like, well, what is he going to do? When is he going to go off? Is he going to go off? Probably not, but let's see. So, yep, that is that. We will leave you the notes in the show notes. We've got, I can't even talk tonight. In the show notes, we will have links to both LSV's article on Zach's deck and LSV's playing of it in Channel Fireball. All right, next topic. What are we doing next? Oh, we're actually right there.
Did you want to say anything about the Community Cup, or I mean, obviously you paid much more attention to it than I did. I actually was watching the stipulation draft from Schuster's perspective earlier.
Okay.
Did you want to mention Community Cup action?
Would you like to? I'm okay with it. It's going to be way far ahead again, and I was trying to avoid that stuff, but I did put it in there in case you wanted to talk about it. If you don't have anything good, if you don't have anything nice you want to say about it, we don't have to talk about it.
Yeah, no, I don't. I was just gonna say that, like, it'd be all you, because like I watch some of it. I'm usually rooting for the community team because I think the design team is usually just full of tool bags. But yeah, no one I really liked was on the design team, or on the community team rather.
Okay.
I know that you like MTA. And I like Kenji. I liked watching Marshall Sutcliffe's videos when he was doing the videos in on Gathering Magic, and Kenji Igashore since has taken over for him. But yeah, not too excited about the Community Cup team.
Okay. Well, we can just move right along then.
Yep, skip it.
Okie doke. So the rest of our show, we're going to dedicate a lot of time to talking about this new format, 2DH. So like I said before, the restrictions are pretty simple in the format. We are running multiplayer or 1v1. With 1v1, we're running a lot of dual commander rules. So you're going to run 30 life. We're going to follow the ban list, et cetera, et cetera. Biggest stipulation is that everything in 2DH has to cost $2 or less. So I'm actually, at this point in recording, the tournament will probably be over, hopefully, because I'm not putting this up tomorrow. So our we're going to talk about this deck that I want to run, and I'm going to get Grampus's evaluation on it. So in an 8-person tournament, 3 rounds, I'm going to be running Obsidian Ghost Council as my deck of choice. My Obsidian deck will be linked to in the show notes, so you guys can check that out. Basically, it's my removal deck. I've been playing this deck for a while without budget, and I've recently adopted the budget for the format, and I am just basically playing all removal, all creatures. It's something I definitely thought Eric would like. So what are the overall thoughts on the deck so far?
The first question I actually wanted to ask you is there's no Oblivion Ring in this deck, which is one of the most popular removal spells in white in Commander at large, and I'm almost 100% sure that it's inside the cost restriction for the format. And I wanted to sort of get your thoughts on, you have Nevermore, that's the only enchantment in the deck. Why are you not playing any of the sort of Oblivion Ring style removal spells?
I don't like things that stay on the battlefield. This dates back, I think, to when you and I were playing Magic. I, you know, used to play a lot of Oblivion Ring, used to play a lot of, you know, those style effects, Fiend Hunter even. I got over them really quick. People started playing removal like that against me, and I started playing more of my own kinds of artifact enchantment removal. So maybe it's just me gaming myself, but I just in general felt like playing Oblivion Ring lent itself to some other problems. I also can't stand having a card in my hand on my turn when I want to have instant speed things, and this deck is really trying to operate on how fast I can clear things away. So that was one of the biggest stipulations, was like how quickly can I respond to somebody doing something, and I wanted to be able to do that on their turn. So ergo, no Oblivion Ring.
That makes sense. I see. Also, you know, even you yourself, you have Akroma's Vengeance, you have you know, Merciless Eviction that could potentially be blowing up your own stuff. So that kind of, and Planar Cleansing as well, that kind of thing makes sense to me. And
okay, well, hold on real quick. So some of those things, just so you can see, are in the maybe board. That's sort of my sideboard of stuff. So this is like an extra arsenal of ideas that I have for the deck, just so you can kind of differentiate between, and the folks following at home can understand. So the main deck is et cetera. Some of the other cards are, you know, that you're mentioning, specifically Planar Cleansing and Chromas. These are just ideas that want to go in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I'm thinking that as you, you know, continue to improve the deck, I tend to work in such a pattern that, like, I start out with a lot of cards that I just feel like playing, you know, things I want to try out, things that I've had on the sidelines for a while and have never made a final list. So I'll start out with those things in the deck, but I'll, like you, have this huge maybe board of, you know, 25 removal spells and like an exsanguinate and, you know, like the more choice threats, the things that I knew were going to be in the deck all along, but I didn't put it in the original list because I wanted to try other things out. So particularly for you, I know that there's a couple of cards in your maybe board that you are very fond of, like Grim Discovery.
Yeah.
I'm particularly fond of Blind Obedience. I think Blind Obedience is just great in regular Commander, all restrictions aside. It's just a pretty darn good card.
Yeah.
We got the Kitaki, who we spent more time than he really deserves talking about in this podcast already.
Yeah.
Hymn to Turok, which I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah.
You know, there's just some cards in your maybe board that I expect will be rotated into the starting lineup at some point. You know, maybe once you get more information.
Well, show me the hits real quick. So, like, are these the hits basically that you've just mentioned? Blind, Hymn to Turok. I mean, I guess I'm just asking simply because, you know, there's a lot of mana cost considerations. I mean, I know I'm only running two colors, and that's one of the big things I wanted to mention, was that, you know, I am only running two colors for a specific reason, because I want to get narrower in the metagame. And I feel like monocolor will get obliterated, because of how many colors other people are running. But at the same time, you know, you can't have a turn two Hymn to Turok in a white black deck. It's just very hard to do.
Yeah, the mana bases for these decks, because of this $2 restriction, tend to be very loose. And you see there's going to be a lot of basics. Basically, the biggest cost of putting together a constructed deck in any Magic format is the mana base. It's true in Modern. It's true in Legacy. It's true in Vintage. These cards, these highly playable lands, tend to go into multiple decks. So the demand for them is driven up so high that there'd definitely be more than $2. And you have a lot of, you know, good stuff, like Evolving Wilds, Myriad Landscape, Nubinalia, things that would normally be seen in commander decks, but then you've also got, you know, the full 24 basics, which if you had a multicolored commander deck, probably not going to have that many basics, you know, unless you're really ramping hard with my preferred method of ramp. But that's definitely a consideration. And something like Planar Cleansing, I think, can add a lot in terms of power level to your deck. But triple white is like, you never know exactly where your draw is going to end up in terms of the split of colors. And not being able to cast your Planar Cleansing is a big problem.
Well, here's one of the interesting things about this deck in particular. Before I even began building it, really, I knew that I needed, you know, I wanted to play Obsidat, and I decided that, hey, we need to build around it. So I started building around him. And when I built around him, I realized, hey, I don't have the ramp. I don't have these things. How do I solve this problem? Well, in the original version, I was actually playing 41 lands, but I was playing all the good stuff. I had Marsh Flats. I had Fetid Heath. I had my Isolated Chapel, you know, some extra Godless Shrine, some extra things that would help me fixing so that I could hit turn 5 Obsidat. So this deck is actually designed with the land drops to hit turn 5 Obsidat very consistently. I would say I very rarely miss it. Even at 39, as I've been testing, still doing pretty well with that. And that's one of the considerations. I mean, when you have such an aggressive, you know, or a heavy cost like Obsidat's mana, you're going to want to try to do that. And so I definitely built into that into the factors as I was designing the deck.
Yeah, and I feel like that's a big strategy point in any deck that plays Obsidat is if you've got it, you kind of just want to put it in play because the sooner you can get it down, the more value you're going to get off of it, off of the, you know, this flipping in and out of the battlefield and draining the opponent, that matters. And, you know, on your side, having sorcery speed removal like board sweepers can sort of inhibit that game plan. Like you can't afford to be clearing the board on your turn. If anything, you need to clear it on your opponent's turn because of the fact that you plan to have an Obsidat in play, generally speaking, during your turn. That's, you know, if you're winning that game, a big part of your game plan is, well, I just have a huge 5/5 hasty threat every turn that you can't really deal with unless you've got instant speed removal.
Yeah. So let's run down real quick an average sort of like game plan that I want to have with this deck. And this is sort of the way that I designed it. But obviously, with the amount of instant removal and disruption that I sort of have, I can really, I have a little bit more flexibility within this, but this is essentially the plan. Is the early game, I want to try to get stuff down. So if I've got rocks, I want to play mana rocks. I want to play some of my little utility dudes or Miri Landscape or Morak Replica, Phyrexian Rager, just something to draw me a couple of cards to make sure that I'm making sure that I'm hitting my land drops up until turn 5. Around turn 4, I want to be looking for a Wrath. There's a couple of decks in the game, in the meta game right now that are pretty aggressive. There's a mono red aggro deck that's playing basically all ones and two drops. And I want to make sure that I have, you know, the best spell probably in this situation is Black Sun Zenith. Just simply because it hoses everything and I don't really lose a whole lot of ground. I don't lose a card to Black Sun Zenith. So that's like the card of choice there. Around turn 5 is when I want to cast Obsidat. If he gets countered, I've got, you know, a sort of decision tree for that. But essentially, you want to get him down, like you said, and just start letting him exile every turn and coming back into play and attacking if I can.
I have a couple more cards that I thought were a little wonky that I want to ask you about, and then we can get into some of my favorite cards that you're playing.
Yeah.
The first one I want to ask about is right at the top of the list here, alphabetically at least, Batwing Broom, which is a hybrid black-white, but generally speaking, it's a fog effect. What do you feel like this deck really is doing that needs a fog effect?
So I just thought it's a black-white spell. It's funny. It's one of my favorite cards in this color combination, and so it's more of like a pet card thing. I have actually had to use it a couple of times, and I've won a couple of games off of it too. So I feel like it's worth a slot, even though, because I don't really draw it a whole lot, but when I do draw it, I do use it, and people have to respect it. Like, you know, that's essentially the plan. So as soon as this new metagame starts to respect the Batwing Broom, then I'll probably take it out.
Yeah, I have very similar thoughts about fog effects, and I think that I have a strange evaluation. So like I won't play them in general, but they tend to be very good because a lot of the ways you lose EDH games, particularly against swarm decks, is they'll have 5 to 10 tokens of something, you know, some type, and then they'll play an overrun style effect or maybe Triumph of the Hordes, or maybe they're going to deal damage with a large X spell or something like that. And being able to prevent all damage, you know, Batwing Broom is just combat damage, but there's other ways that you can get out of all damage, period. But effects like this tend to be very good because people overinvest resources in one turn wins. You know, they're building up until they can just, oh, we're going off right now and that's it. So I feel like having at least one of these is worth it. Having multiples can really start to tilt people. They're like, oh my God, you had safe passage. And like, oh my God, he has this other thing. Like, what am I doing? Like, I just got tangled, you know? And just like, it's really tilting to some people that you get them thinking about it. And it's only 2% of your deck or whatever. But suddenly they're playing around cards that aren't even universally good, but like also you don't even have in your hand. So they're just really, they don't even want to cast their Overrun anymore. And their deck no longer performs the same way because they're afraid you might be able to come back and get them. So that is a tricky decision to make, and you really have to be getting into that psychological game that I love so much. Mm-hmm. One of the other cards that I wanted to point out was
just a quick comment on Batwing Broom.
Okay, go ahead.
So we talked about how awesome it is, how I love the name, I love, you know, this card. I just think it's a sweet design overall. I really, you know, really do like it. One of the, you know, you were talking about, in fact, one of the biggest cards, you know, that they play in green decks. There aren't a whole lot of green in the major competitive decks. I posted we'll have this in the show notes as well, the sort of metagame that I may or may not be looking at, and literally maybe one deck is running green. Maybe. So That gives you a pretty good idea of like of what I'm expecting. But Triumph of the Hordes is definitely a 1v1 like almost staple in most of the green decks. So just, you know, that's what it's there for. I've got a couple of other things that can kind of mitigate that, and obviously the removal helps too.
Yeah. Well, so I think that basically anything you can do to minimize the effectiveness of Overrun effects, because they tend to be quite popular, is probably worth thinking about. You know, not all decks have access to it, not all decks necessarily need protection from ground assault, but it should be a player in the metagame. Yeah.
Because I don't play a whole lot of creatures at all, like this is a card. Like, and I want to be attacking with my Obsidat. If I have an open field or somebody's tapped out, I want to be able to attack. So like this helps me do that.
Mm-hmm. The other card that I found a little questionable that I wanted to talk about was Wall of Reverence, which is it seems kind of strange because, like, let's do a quick comparison to Obsidat, your general, which I feel like is sort of the headliner threat. Like, this is what we're doing on 5 mana. This is what we want to have in play. So,
correct.
Given that you have an Obsidat coming out on turn 5, what's the purpose of Wall of Reverence on 4?
So I only have like 2 cards in the deck that I feel are really good on curve with Obsidat, and that I'm willing to tap out for just to get stuff. One of them is Wall of Reverence. The other one is Well of Lost Dreams. These 2 cards are in the deck simply just because I want to be able to start gaining life back in case my life's super low. You know, I'm not underestimating my opponents. Maybe this is me, you know, just these were in the original design. I just didn't take them out. The Well of Lost Dreams helps me draw, so that's obviously something I want to stay. This is another draw trigger I can have with the Well of Lost Dreams, which is a little more Christmas land, but nonetheless not unimportant. It's probably the only other way I really have to gain life before I add a debt to the Deathless, which is actually a really recent add-in. It's just I needed a finisher, need another one to help me finish.
Heck, it certainly is a finisher. I mean, I guess if these games are being played one-on-one, maybe not as much, but if any multiplayer environment, Debt to the Deathless is
dumb.
An extremely, it's just an offensive card in many people's minds. Like, I'm into some pretty brutal stuff in Commander. I think we can both attest to that.
Yeah.
But Debt to the Deathless is, it's on the order of like, wow, you just strip mined me on turn one. You're a real dick, man. Like,
it really is.
You brought this, you know, like it's bringing a Mac 10 to a bow and arrow fight. You know, it's really bad.
Yeah. So Wall of Reverence is just there to kind of help me gain a little bit of life. I was actually surprised. I got it out in a couple of games, and it really helped stop some of the things that my opponents were trying to do. You know, if I can buy a turn with a Wall of Reverence, I'm going to do it. You know, this deck needs to buy all the turns it can get.
Okay. Well, you know, obviously the fact that Obsidat does not stay in play on your opponent's turn limits its blocking potential, and you do need to make up for that. But I tend to play few, if any, cards that have the word Defender anywhere on them.
Yeah, well, stacking the triggers helps me out too, because I can gain 5 life and then let Obsidat leave, which is super cool too.
If you can assemble, you know, the machine, it definitely works out. So now I want to get into cards that you know, I'm excited to see, you know,
yeah,
cards that I like to play quite a bit and I want to sort of highlight here. The first is Retaliate.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is dramatically underplayed in Commander at large.
For sure.
You know, essentially an instant speed Day of Judgment, because the majority of creatures that you're worried about are going to be the ones who are beating you down. You know, like they're going to be dealing damage to you at some point.
Yeah.
Obviously, this excludes the possibility of destroying utility creatures, but it also has the upside that you never have to destroy any of your own creatures, which is fantastic. And instant speed, you know, has all sorts of tempo gains associated with it. Makes the card very good. So, you know, I'm really happy to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Unexpectedly Absent is another card that I've raved about for,
a couple
of years now. This card is absurd. It's just crazy how good this is, and nobody cares.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't think that there's a white deck in the format that could not be substantially improved by just taking out a random card, I don't care what it is, and putting in Unexpectedly Absent. There's so many people playing so much garbage that they just need to stop and play this instead.
Wizards, I think, saw the templating almost for Chaos Warp and go, what does white Chaos Warp look like? And they made Unexpectedly Absent.
Yeah, this card is
it's basically the same
fantastic
thing.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I think it did the same thing for white that red got when Chaos Warp printed.
Yeah. Moving on, Wing Shards, a card that I've played in every white deck I've assembled for years.
Yeah.
Basically, I don't leave home without it.
Yeah.
Card is kind of bananas.
I can't afford not to, considering like the way that the meta is. I mean, a lot of these decks are going to have blue. Some of them are going to have counter spells. Being able to let them cast multiple spells before they attack, you know, they really have to plan against me because I brought all the removal and they're not going to be able to counter every single Wing Shards if they want to play four spells before somebody flips Narset, you know?
Yeah. Wing Shards, you know, obviously, as a sacrifice effect, we typically think sacrifice effects are weaker against large boards or decks that are capable of producing multiple tokens. But you can pretty easily create a Wing Shards for three or four, or, you know, even more, depending on how crazy people get in multiplayer games. But suddenly, that's a substantial portion of people's boards, even if they're playing a Swarm deck.
Yeah.
Wing Shards kills a lot of stuff, and it just so happens to all be in one player's board. It doesn't hurt anything you're doing. It can end up taking out multiple creatures for a very low price. I'm a big fan of this card.
Well, you'll notice also that there's a lot of Sacrifice and Exile. Not that this isn't uniquely, you know, like the white-black thing to do, but in like a total flavor win, I guess. But this is also sort of the metagame. I mean, the big decks in the format right now are Zergo and Tajik. You know, these indestructible things that I can't really get around, or hexproof things that I can't really get around, like Narset. They're some of the better decks. And if they don't have that, then they have counterspells. So being able to get around that by targeting players, being able to get around stuff by exile effects, this is all the kind of cards that I want to be playing in this deck to make sure that I'm beating up my opponents.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've mentioned Narset a couple times now. And
yeah.
Having only discussed this format for a short amount of time, and I haven't played any games of 2DH and don't have extensive experience of the format, but I think that's where I'd start. And that's actually the secret video project we've been hinting at for a while, or I've been hinting at for a while. That's one of the decks that I'm playing is a Narset Commander deck, because this card should cost more, quite frankly. Like, this card does some pretty, just really gross things, and it has a potential to get really abusive. Anytime you cast things for free, like, I think we've learned our lesson there.
Xur, I mean, it's basically Jeskai Xur, like, in my opinion.
It is, but with the, you know,
so many more things.
Yeah, you don't get exactly what you want every single time, but you also have the potential upside of, hey, you know, this time I got three relevant things instead of just one. I think overall I'd take tutoring for a specific card over flipping the top four and casting all those relevant cards. However, I'd always take Hexproof over not. And
yeah,
it turns out that Hexproof just is really annoying. You know, it's something we've heard for many years, and I think that they should stop printing cards with that word on it. It's tough to deal with. Moving on, the next card I want to talk about is Identity Crisis, which has long been a maybe not a pet card because I don't play it all the time, but it's a card that I'm constantly trying to wedge into my new deck list because I want to play it, but I, you know, I don't always necessarily have the room. And I'm glad to see you found space in this deck. What's Identity Crisis doing?
It's one of the cards, again, I think. So this is a card that came into the deck similar when Debt to the Deathless came in. Literally, I slotted them in, like, sleeved them up at pretty much the same time, one after the other. The idea was, if I, you know, have Obsidat and I have all these things, I still need to be able to win with my Obsidat. And I need to make sure that they can't do anything, you know, my opponents can't do anything else. So the idea there was simply just, you know, make sure to hose them and do it well. So I'm trying to do that. Again, you have an Obsidat and then you have a turn six. So I feel like, you know, on curve, I'm kind of doing the same thing that I would be doing if I had a Wrath. A lot of times people will hold up if they know you're going to play Wrath, not deck. This says, no, you can't play. You can't do that. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one question I do want to ask you about this is, how do you feel like this compares to Mind Shatter? Because obviously Mind Twist would be the optimal card for getting your opponent to discard a bunch of things, but that's way too expensive to be playable in this type of format. Mind Shatter, though, is potentially scalable and kind of fits the same mold. Why did you decide to go with Identity Crisis over Mind Shatter?
I think just because it was in colors and I would prefer to try to have a little bit of variance in my decks. I thought that I was going to be, you know, I have another deck we can talk about here. And that deck actually has more of the sort of Hymn to Taraki kind of cards like Mind Shatter that was going in there. Mind Shatter is definitely a card that's on the list for this deck. It's not in my baby board, but it's something that was on my radar. I think you might be keying into something there. That over Identity Crisis, Mind Shatter over Identity Crisis, and then Debt to the Deathless probably should just be taken out for Exsanguinate if I'm playing 1v1, right? I mean, just better.
Yeah. If that's the only thing that's happening, well, I guess it sort of depends. I think that they're both very good in multiplayer, but don't necessarily carry the same weight in single player. The only consideration I would think is that in a single player game where all the disruption in a game is going to be directed solely at you, putting together a Debt to the Deathless that's very large is going to be a little bit more difficult than putting together a large Exsanguinate. You know, 9 mana and Exsanguinate is
7.
Yeah, like that's a pretty big deal. 9 mana for a Debt to the Deathless, like with the extra mana restrictions, it's not necessarily as easy to pull off. You might be waiting and like, okay, I've got a 3-turn window in which I'm going to cast this to get the mana right and get it the right size or where it can win. But if you're waiting on, you know, any of those factors for an amount of time, you might not be able to get it. They might have a counterspell by that time. They might have made you discard it. So I tend to think that the ability to go small with Exsanguinate ends up being a little bit better, because in close games, 3 to 4 life will make the difference. Whereas if you were able to cast a sorcery for 8+ mana and make Debt to the Deathless better, well, you should just be winning that game. You know, if you can cast a huge sorcery and get away with it, you pretty much already won, in my opinion.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I just, you know, these are cards that I kind of like to. I just like Identity Crisis better. Look, it's better looking. You know, it's just a nicer thing.
It's way more fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it's way more fun than Mind Shatter. I mean, yeah. You know, because it's in color, it's, you know, it's something that doesn't get played a whole lot, as you mentioned. I like that. I also really like Debt to the Deathless. I remember in your Dragon's Maze review, you were like, this card, it has the most uncomfortable art, and I love that about this. You know, it's just so uncomfortable. Like, it makes me uncomfortable looking at it too, you know, like these fountains of blood, like
fountains of blood coming from faceless gargoyle. Yeah, like this card has some disturbing art. But you know, the reason really to me that motivated me to originally write that is that somebody had to sculpt this, and the art is very symmetrical. So they didn't just make one gargoyle fountain of blood. They had to make it times two. Like, they created this whole image, and they're like, oh, well, let's just reflect it across the room here, and we'll put it on the other wall too. And I can almost imagine zooming out, and you've got a whole cathedral full of dozens of these things, and the associated blood pumping mechanisms that all feel like, who are these people? It's like, they are really gross. They make me uncomfortable.
It's kind of like it's like a gothic version of what you see in A Clockwork Orange with that weirdo milk bar.
Oh god.
That's you know, it's like uncomfortable, right? Like, it's just weird.
We've gone to a dark place.
Yeah, I mean,
we really have.
And so did artist, I think that's Seb McKinnon is his name. Yeah. So thanks, Seb McKinnon. You made us go to our dark place.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely some good examples of weird, gross, uncomfortable magic art out there, and this is at the near the top of the list for me.
Okay. So Debt to Deathless, Identity Crisis could, you know, potentially be taken out for Mind Shatter and Exsanguinate, which I probably will do, you know, just in last minute tweaks before I go play. Let's see. So what else? What other cards are jumped out at you, or you know?
Well, the next card that I really like that I want to talk about is Raven's Crime.
Yeah.
And you know, with a restriction like this, where you're going to be playing a lot of basic lands because they're cheap and you can't play more expensive options, you might find yourself with several lands that you don't necessarily need in your hand. Raven's Crime is just a really good card. I'm a big fan of like, oh, well, I have Raven's Crime in my opening hand, so this is my game plan now. We're just going to play a very competitive resource war. You know, like I'm willing to discard as many lands as I draw to make sure that, you know, you're discarding a bunch of cards. And if people start changing their decision making throughout the process of what do I discard, you know, they're going to start out, well, maybe I have an extra land, so I'll discard that. And then maybe they'll discard another land and be like, wow, I'm not getting to 8 mana if I keep discarding lands. So let me start discarding expensive cards. And suddenly you're trading your swamp for their game ending threat. This, as long as you can sort of mentally work your way through the maze of this exchange, you end up trading very favorably in terms of the card quality when you're using Raven's Crime. Because obviously with the retrace, you can only use lands, but they can be tricked into discarding higher and higher value cards, which over the course of a long game is very relevant. They just price themselves out of being able to use their deck's most effective cards.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about this card too, because I had one of my biggest questions was, I'm playing Duress and I'm playing Raven's Crime, and the choice for that was, I actually, right now in my brain, which is part of the reason that I have this other mono black deck that we can talk about, I really wanted to have a deck that was playing turn one Disruption. I really wanted to have it. I think that it's something that could be good potentially for the future of 2DH in this format. There's a bunch of really cool little Despise, Ostracize. I think there's another one that discards a non-basic land. Anyway, I wanted to have a deck that played all of these. And I thought, well, maybe my Obsidak deck can be the one that does this. But what I realized is two things. Number one, this card got suggested to me. One of the guys was kind of sitting there. I pulled apart my deck after a game, and he was saying that, you know, play Raven's Crime. And I was like, yeah, this is right, because number one, I am playing more land than probably anyone in this metagame is going to be playing. I am at 39 land, and most of the people in this format play somewhere between 33 and 37 if they're, you know, actually trying. And I just feel like that's like the danger zone almost if you're playing, you know, 37 and you're not in a green deck. But being able to sculpt your hand is part of the reason that our land average is so low. However, with that said, they're still playing higher amounts of land destruction. So we've got the Tajik deck, we've got the Zergo deck, we've got, I think there's another deck that's playing some land destruction effects. I'm playing more land than everyone else. So this is part of my competitive advantage, is having 39 lands. So if you want to blow my lands, go ahead. I'll make sure to plan around it. I can hold those up. I can wait till you do that and then start playing lands again. This is the thing. Or I have part of this Raven's Crime plan where I can retrace all these lands and make you discard whatever you want anyway. So this is part of the design. Part of the reason that I cut a lot of the other turn one disruption effects other than basically Duress and Raven's Crime. Because I felt that Duress was something, you know, Duress and Appetite for Brains were the last spot, honestly, because if somebody kept a turn, you know, an opener with Armageddon in it, I want to be able to get rid of it. I felt that that was just more important than anything else that they could do creature-wise, otherwise, because most people just want to play their commander and beat face.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I'm not going to argue against turn one disruption. If Duress ran for president, I would vote for it. I mean, like, what are you going to do? The card's just bananas. Great. It's responsible for so many turn one wins. Like, you want to win on turn one? Don't play a combo deck. Play Duress. Just look at your opponent's face while they reconsider their past mistakes. That's all you need. Like, you don't have to figure out how to play Magic. They have to figure out how to live with themselves after keeping some nonsense hands. It's great. And I feel like, you know, the more of this kind of effect that you can cram into a deck, the better. I think it honestly does just raises your win percentage without changing anything about your skill level. You don't have to play better. Just draw more Duresses.
Yeah.
Because people tend to build their decks pretty loose in EDH. That's just how it goes. It's not a hyper competitive Legacy or Vintage metagame. People will lose to it. It gets pretty ugly.
Eric's favorite movie, 27 Duresses.
Oh my god.
One of the other things I want to mention about Raven's Crime before we move along, you were talking about how cool it is with the quadrant theory. This is something that I definitely took into effect when I was trying to figure out which one of these discard effects that I wanted to play on turn one. And I think that Raven's Crime interacted more favorably with what I'm trying to do, because once I get to a certain point in the game, Raven's Crime is a card that I really want to be able to stop my I want to be able to stop my opponents from doing something so that I can, you know, get my last card out. And this helps weed out counterspells quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So
I feel like the availability of disruption in this format, because removal and discard and counterspells tend to be commons or uncommons, they tend to be less expensive. So really what you're missing out on is the single card wins, like the very expensive threats or some potential combo cards that are playable in other formats. Those things aren't going to be available in 2DH. But the best disruption cards are. So you're going to see a metagame, and, you know, at least from my early assessments, you're going to see a metagame where disruption is very available and people should be taking advantage of that.
So let's see. What other cards do you like here in the list? Are there any more?
Set's Tiger. That's what I want to talk about.
Freaking A. Yeah.
Set's Tiger, the probably like the Benchwarmer award of the century for Commander. This card has been, you know, been around for a while, and a lot of people want to play it, and it's, in my opinion, it's pretty cool. It's a great design, and I hope that this is a future sight card, so I hope that it sees a non-future sight print in some set. I don't know when that's going to be, but I think that the design is pretty sweet, and given that we were just talking about so much disruption, you know, particularly with regards to targeted discard, well, giving yourself protection from, I don't know, black, red, that could be relevant. This card is pretty sweet.
Yeah, man. I can't tell you how many jams I've gotten out of with this card. Set's Tiger is a fog when I want him to be. He is a counter-target Mind Twist. He's a counter-target Gifts Ungiven. That's one of my favorites. Counter-target Factor Fiction. Like, a lot of times, you just straight up get out of a lot of tight jams.
And things
you don't want to see.
Yeah, that's Set's Tiger almost, to me, feels like this format's Snapcaster Mage. Would you agree with that sentiment?
It's it's very close. This card is awesome, but it's nowhere near the other card that I thought you might want to talk about, which is Blowout.card, Angel of the Dire Hour. This card is an incredible blowout. If Set's Tiger is a Snapcaster Mage, Angel of the Dire Hour is my Aether Spouts.
It's a 7 mana. Like, that's pretty late in the game, and I feel like if you're casting big time cards like that, you really ought to win. And this card certainly enables you to do that. It definitely empowers victory.
I can't tell you how many times people just
can't get
eat
out of that
it.
Situation.
They just eat it. Oh my goodness, it's so good. It's beyond good. It's not fair, Eric. It really isn't fair.
This card sees quite a bit of play in normal Commander. So I would wholeheartedly expect it to be in 2DH. I feel like if something's playable in Commander at large, then you can for sure expect to see it in 2DH if the restriction, you know, will allow it.
Okay.
And the same could be said of, Vault the Archangel or Sunblast Angel, Divinity of Pride. You know, there's just a bunch of cards that maintain low price tags because of their
reprints.
Relative unplayability in other formats or their reprints. That, yeah, why not play them? They were good enough for a higher or like larger card pool. They're definitely going to be playable in a smaller card pool.
Well, I mean, some of these cards, again, they transferred from the deck's original design. Angel of the Dire Hour has been like the biggest blowout, I think, of all of them. I expected it to be good, but I did not expect it to be as good as it has been. It's so insane. This is another card that's just, if you see me with 7 mana open, I don't know how you even think about attacking. I just don't.
It's tough to predict 7 mana cards. Like, I feel like I'm pretty good at analyzing and predicting the general texture of people's opening hands. But when it's turn 7, like, you've got 1 or 2 cards left, I don't know what the hell that is. Like, it could be anything at this point, you know.
Yeah.
Your entire deck is open. Like, you're going to play pretty much whatever you draw as long as it's relevant. So if you've been holding something for a while, my head is just racing with the possibilities. And I'm going to walk right into this. Why not? Like, I think I'm winning. I think I'm attacking for damage, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It's probably one of my favorite top decks to get, you know, because you're just like, well, okay, you know, now I have another. The part that I think is the most underrated is the fact that it's a 5/4 flyer, because then now I have actual another threat other than Obsidian. And that's been like probably the biggest help. I mean, that it's the thing that helps me kill people quicker. So,
oh yeah.
You know.
This, I mean, if we were talking about Seth's Tiger being the Snapcaster Mage, yeah, I think a better analog is almost like this Angel of the Dire Hour is this format's Elesh Norn a little bit. Like
yeah,
you play it,
actually, yeah.
Their board no longer exists, and now you're beaten down. We're like we're just going to the face. It ends games in a like an embarrassingly one-sided fashion. That previously those games were close,
yeah,
but they don't look that way anymore.
Half the reason for, you know, like I'm playing Scout's Warning because this card is a cantrip, and we can talk about the cantrips in a little bit, I'm sure. But you know, being able to do that with even Divinity of Pride is pretty good. So far, I've had a lot of great experience with doing that, or like being able to flash in opposite at the end of somebody's turn. Especially against blue players, this really trips them up because they're like, well, he can't cast Obsidat or he can't cast a creature. Well, boom, here I am. You know, so these are the things that I like to do with, you know, this is one of the reasons that I'm playing Scout's Warning to begin with is that Angel of Dire Hour was just so good. I was like, why not just get a card that replaces itself and have a good creature?
Why not? Yeah, I mean, flashing in Lifelinkers has historically been a good play in pretty much every Magic format. Like, if you think that you're winning the damage race, you're going to be inclined to attack. And the minute that information becomes incorrect, you feel like a huge idiot. Because, like, suddenly you're attacking in a situation where you should have been blocking. The math doesn't favor you. Lifelink changes math instantly, and it's tough to predict. Again, when your creatures have flash, you just don't know what your opponent is holding, and you can't visualize the situation changing unless you know what's in their hand.
So it's just been good, just been really awesome. The Scout's Warning, you know, just nobody expects it, really, and rightly so, again.
Yeah, Scout's Warning traditionally been underplayed in Commander. I've talked about it several times in articles, and I know you have, yep, as well. It gets a lot of love, I guess, from the underplayed tech articles,
yep,
but still has not seen wider adoption.
And it's a shame.
And, you know, this is another one of those cards. It's Future Sight. You know, it wasn't one of the future shifted cards, mm-hmm, but could potentially come back at some point in the future. Like, it's a Magic card that makes sense. You know, it's not one of these Robo Rosewater cards that will, yeah, never get printed. Like, this card could be back, and I feel like that would help sort of drive the awareness. And if maybe this was printed in Standard and people saw what it could do in Standard, then they'd be more inclined to play it in Commander.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Scout's Warning, just to diverge off a tangent before we get back to what, you know, some of the cards that you wanted to hit, maybe this will hit some of the cards too. A lot of people say white, you know, white decks don't draw cards. Well, this deck finds a lot of ways to draw cards off of silly cantrips, and most of them happen to be white. You like Shelter, for example, is one of my favorite cards that I found recently. It has like Penelope Cruz or some Hayek on it, I think. And just take your pick.
The when I look at this card, I see the girl from Flashdance.
Oh.
Or not Flashdance, Dirty Dancing.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. When she's in her, yeah, sweater and her, you know,
Demi Moore
high-waisted shorts. I don't know who that person is. My mother loves that movie. I can't stand it.
Well, so Shelter is one and a white. Target creature you control gains protection from the color of your choice until end of turn. Draw a card. This is, I think, a card that I'm very surprised that I don't see a lot more of. Again, just going off of this topic, simply because it's like a counterspell almost in white. You know, a lot of times you want to play a threat. You want to protect your threat. But you know what else we want to do? We want to draw cards, and we're in white. So, you know, where are the parents at? Where are the parents at, Eric?
Yeah. Well, you know, you have in your deck list Cloud Shift, mm-hmm, which for like Cloud Shift is great. Don't get me wrong. Like it does pretty much everything you'd want your combat trick to do. Like it expands the possibility for value. It protects against removal. It can potentially act as a counterspell like you talked about. This card is great. But Shelter oftentimes takes the same role, but also draws you a card in every situation.
Yeah.
How is it's unclear to me how drawing a card is not worth one generic mana, you know, one colorless mana. I'd pretty much take that deal every single time. If you want to actually add that to the card five more times, I will still play it.
Yeah, I really love Shelter. It's been pretty very helpful, especially in getting that last set of damage through with Obsidat. People want to try to remove it or respond to it, you know, in response to exile. This is another great way to answer people's you know, whatever they have in their hand to try to stop my Obsidat, because I just need Obsidat to keep going in and out of play in order to help win me the game. So that's one of the biggest cantrip tricks that I have in the deck is Shelter. the other one that I want to talk about, which is a little weird, and I was surprised this wasn't like one of your big hits and, you know, asking why.
Can I guess what I... Oh, yeah, okay. I was going to say, there were two cards that I thought you were going to say. One was Nivea's Wisp, one was Equal Treatment.
Okay.
Equal Treatment is a little strange. However, I've seen people play this card in Commander when they know they're going to be attacking for one damage quite a bit. You know, it can very easily turn 1/1 tokens into, oh wow, you know suddenly you're like instant speed Glorious Anthem that costs one less mana now also draws you a card, and like, you know, by the way, this is a burn spell for 6 and I draw a card, you know, just sorry, I'm just putting you on notice there, bro. Equal Treatment is capable of doing some pretty interesting things.
I have not heard of the opposite way. I can tell you that I've used it in fantastic ways already, one of which being that I straight up ate like a 17 cast mana Devil's Play with Equal Treatment. It was awesome.
Yeah.
That one, you know, definitely Nivea's Wisp was a card I thought you might ask me about. We'll get to that in a second. Just to talk about Equal Treatment real quick. I really enjoy this because it's, again, untargetable. There's a lot of cards, again, in the meta that I can't handle, you know, Narset, you know, things like that if they want to trick it up. Well, congratulations. You can give me the double strike you want. It's still going to deal 2 damage. So, anyway, Equal Treatment, super cool.
Yeah, Equal Treatment. They're definitely not expecting this Spanish Inquisition, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Most people, if you told them the text or the name of this card, they wouldn't be able to put 2 and 2 together. Like, yeah. Nobody really knows this card exists.
If you have it
in your deck, you can feel confident that the other player is going to have to flip it around and read it maybe twice and then look at you really funny and then be like, okay, well...
Did we read it? We need to read this. Okay.
So I'm scooping up my cards.
Okay, so Equal Treatment is 1 and a white. It's an instant. And it says, if any source would deal 1 or more damage to a creature or player this turn, it deals 2 damage to that creature or player instead. Draw a card. So the idea that Eric's talking about, so you have a person that's, oh, I have a 1 damage token. Nope, it's 2. That's like the opposite of the way that you want to deal with this card.
Yeah. I feel like white cards don't typically make things deal more damage.
Yeah.
But this card says if a source would deal 1 or more, so if it deals 1, suddenly you can make it deal 2 damage. Well, like, that's a burn spell. You got a burn spell going right there.
Yeah.
If you've got obviously, you're meant to use this, so you're taking huge quantities of damage from, you know, a small threat base. You can reduce it. That's the more white, I guess, use of the card.
Yeah.
But I'm always thinking of, like, is there a way that I can use something to kill my opponent? Because that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
I sleeved up a bunch of cards with the intention of winning the game. Mm-hmm. It turns out there are situations that you can engineer in this format where Equal Treatment makes people look real silly.
So
I don't universally recommend it. I'm just saying it will be funny and be awesome when you play it.
Yeah. Equal Treatment, again, sort of, you know, going off of this kind of having fogs, but not fogs. You know, this is a lesser fog, obviously, and it's something that I could definitely play in response to somebody, you know, say Tajik gets its battalion trigger. So now it's a 7-cost thing. Well, guess what? Now you're not doing 7 damage to me anymore. And here's another card that I need because I don't want this Equal Treatment in my hand. So
yeah.
It's just awesome. I just love it to death. If if people try to do stuff, it's just a way to say no. Nivea's Wisp. Now, this is a card I was actually playing against you, I think, a long time ago. I've been playing this card for several years, and I swear by it. This is, I think, the best Wisp in my mind. The red one is good. The blue one's okay. But the white one is the best one because it's offense, it's defense, and it draws you a card for 1 white. This is the kind of cantrip I can truly get behind. It's a great trick. And my favorite thing of all time, so I have to tell you about this play, because it's actually in this Obsidite deck, is in the original design of the Obsidite deck. It's, you know, we're trying to use it to try to get blockers out of the way. Well, I was playing a game 1v1 against my opponent, and this was pre-tuck rule. He decides to try to condemn my Obsidite, which would have really hosed the deck. We're in combat. Obsidite's been declared attack. I cast Nivea's Wisp, targeting Obsidite to draw a card. I have Undying Evil in my hand, and I draw into Doomblade. So Obsidite's white. I go cast Doomblade on Obsidite, cast Undying Evil in response to that. So I was able to avoid the condemn by creating a whole new target.
Well, that doesn't work. I guess you got one. So Obsidite is black.
No, because Nivea's Wisp made it white.
Oh.
because layers.
Is it? Yeah, I don't even understand this. So like, It's already white, but like it becomes white only.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
Yeah, because it's like a Nim Death Mantle, dude. Like, is black.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah.
Is a black zombie. Yeah.
You got me. I do not have a perfect understanding of the rules. I think that's maybe that is not well publicized, but it's been documented.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Magic is complex.
No. This is a weird combo, dude. So it was kind of a nombo. I mean,
well,
it took me.
Kudos to you for seeing that. I would have swept right over that.
Yeah, man. It was an insane play. I couldn't believe I was able to get out of that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, hey, man. Nivea's Wisps, at least against me, because I typically only have one creature in play at a time. Mm-hmm. I'm the guy casting 6 or 7 Wrath of Gods per game. I can't be throwing a bunch of stuff on the board, so if you can tap one of my creatures, that's a fog in and of itself. This, mm-hmm. against me and many, many decks, you know, if you have like a Voltron deck or something like that, this is just a fog that draws you a card for one mana. Mm-hmm. And if equal treatment is like 3/4 of a fog that draws you a card, this is, it's got to be, you know, at least 4/5 of a fog that draws you a card. This can do a lot. It's definitely worth one mana for sure.
Yeah, I've been playing this, like I said, for several years, and it's always been good. I can't tell you how many times I've played it, but especially against combat narrow decks, you know, when you get into that Voltron-y, you know, kind of thing, and a lot of the decks in this meta, you know, keep going back to them, but you know, Zergo has to attack anyway, but even if he didn't, like, now I just tap him down. Now I just tap him down. Congratulations. That's 7 damage. You know, you've now effectively lost a turn of commander damage. So really cool.
Well, briefly, the decks that he listed that he thought were important in this metagame are Zergo, Helm Smasher, Tajik, Thraxamundar, Ruhan. These decks like to get in, and you know, you're bringing an Obsidat deck to the table, and Obsidat comes back with haste and presumably attacks. That's kind of how the card's supposed to work. This format seems to be based firmly on the battlefield. I actually wanted to ask one question before we move too far away. You'd mentioned before Condemn, mm-hmm. and you have Condemn in your deck list here, so you don't mind playing Condemn even, you know, pre or I guess post rules change where it can no longer really get commanders?
It's not gonna. I needed another card that wasn't swords or path, and I was really missing swords and path.
Yeah.
You know, these are cards that I really, it just, the deck needed to function, and I needed something that would placehold. And I don't mind if my opponent gains, you know, some weak amount of life. A lot of times, I mean, again, considering the meta, Zergo is a 7/2. If you gain 2 life on me, Obsidat's coming back in and taking it back away anyway. Like, you know, a lot of times, and the bigger creatures that I was thinking about were going to be less of a problem than I imagined. So in thinking about it in that way, I did not mind if they went back to the command zone, because Thraxamundar just costs more. Zergo costs more and also gains very little life. The last thing I want to do is give a control deck a life like Thraxamundar, but if I have to, it's there.
Yeah, I generally agree. And I think that a lot of people immediately shifted away from playing Tuck effects in the wake of that decision. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Condemn is still just genuinely playable in Commander, and it's just still pretty good.
Yeah.
It's not too far off from being actual Swords to Plowshares against normal threats. Obviously, they have to be attacking, which is a problem, but not a huge problem. And the same is true of, you know, Spell Crumple and the various counter spells that were typically used to hose Commander specifically, but they still work, you know?
Well, I was playing a game against, you know, one of the better other, you know, kind of decks that's been under the radar and hasn't really been playing the competitive scene is this 1v1 Woodwind deck. And, you know, he attacked with Woodwind, and my opponent attacked with Woodwind. I condemned it, and he just bounced it to his hand because he didn't want to have to cast it from the command zone. Like, now I don't even have to gain life? Okay, we could play that game.
Yeah.
You know, like, I felt less bad about it after I did that in a game.
Well, yeah, you see that a lot. There's many game situations where you can put together that mana is just more relevant than life, and people are willing to pay many life points to save them the expense of future mana. Mm-hmm. Fastbond is a good example, and Fastbond is banned in Commander, but like, if you could get extra mana, would you pay life for it? Yeah. Most people in the general game state of Magic the Gathering would say, yes, I will. I will do that many times over. And it bears, that point bears out in gameplay. Mana becomes very important, even when you have a bunch of it in the late game, because people don't stop tapping out. People have plenty of stuff to do with their mana, and
these big time plays that you're trying to end the game with require so much mana that, well, if you have to spend an extra two or three to recast something, that's a major setback. That could be a full turn's worth of mana because you wanted to cast something that costs 9 this turn.
I don't ever make concessions for that BS. If people make me make that decision, that's just, you know, I'm just like, well, looks like I'm casting this other thing. See you later. Yeah. Like, it's just so much an easier economical perspective. Like, why pay extra mana into something that you've invested in, you know, in most situations? You know, opposite of that being an exclusion in some parts because of the way that it generates tempo coming in and out of play. And you just want to keep the momentum going. Like, whereas, like, if Obsidat were Frost Titan, you know, and somebody wanted to target it, I'd be like, okay, I'll go get it back later.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good point that there's definitely some effects that are worth paying for at any point in the game. And as you lose life over the course of an average game, getting those life points back and sort of swinging that balance means more and more later in the game.
Yeah.
And the fact that Obsidat can do that, it's potentially more relevant than just an example you gave of Widewind the Biting Gale.
Yeah.
It's probably more relevant than just putting a 3/3 flyer in play.
Yeah. There, you know, obviously there's some situations where, like, I don't mind Obsidat dying, you know, if I have Marshall Coup in my hand or I have, you know, some wrath that I want to play, you know, I can then do that. My opponents are giving me the option of doing that. But
yeah, they sort of open the door to you to not lose card advantage through the process of casting your own Void Sweeper.
Honestly, the biggest threats to Obsidat, and one of the reasons I chose it was because of how resilient it is as a threat. Obviously, I don't get to have it on my opponent's turn, but when I do have it, it's relevant. But one of the biggest reasons for that was it almost plays into that pseudo-indestructible concept, except I get value every time it comes back, instead of just having something that's like indestructible my turn or indestructible in general, but super weak. I just thought that this was better. It had better colors, and if I can get those colors to work for me and keep the game going, then, you know, this deck has a high percentage to win, I think, in the super late.
All right. Well, the last question, actually, I want to ask you is, you have Nevermore in your deck.
Yeah.
What do you think you're going to be naming with Nevermore?
9 times out of 10, it's going to be Tajik or Zergo.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm literally naming Zergo Home Smasher, or I'm naming Tajik Blade of the Legion, because that shuts down their deck. They can't do anything about it, and they don't have the removal for it in most cases. They have to draw into stump something like that. If that buys me 2 or 3 turns, great. I have a feeling I might, if I have a Duress in my hand and I get to pre-scout their hand or, you know, do something cool like that, or maybe even like Lapse of Certainty something, I have a little bit of information, so hey, I could name, you know, whatever their card is. I just thought it would be cool to be able to Nevermore somebody's commander and just hose them straight up, because people are so reliant on their commanders. I mean, even this deck is, but fortunately for me, again, I'm playing around your nonsense. I have how many enchantment artifact removals? Disenchant, Fate Forgotten, Return to Dust, Utter End, like Unexpectedly Absent if I need to do that. There's plenty of ways for me to destroy their stuff before I, Mortify if it's, you know, their Nevermore. And then I have my creatures too, Ashen Rider, Archon of Justice. This would be obviously in the later game. You know, just ways to own them if they try to do it against me. So,
yeah. Interestingly, the first time that I saw Nevermore actually used was in a cube draft. It, you know, when the card first came out, it subsequently showed up in the MTGO cube. And the universal first name was Jace the Mind Sculptor in that format, which, you know, makes sense. But like, if you're playing, I was playing blue deck, obviously, at this point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's probably not going to show up in the 2DH format. A lot of things would have to change about the game before Jace the Mind Sculptor becomes a $2 card.
Thrax and Mundar, just, I think it's straight up hosed by Nevermore if they can't counter it. Like, this is just a thing, you know?
Yeah, that could be tough. I can see that.
You know, I think the Ruhan deck might have trouble with it too. I think he just plays counterspells. I don't think he plays removal. He plays like a Wrath effect, but, you know, good luck trying to Obsidat, Wrath Obsidat, so. Or any of my other, like, 14 creatures that really don't care about being Wrathed.
Hey, man, artifact enchantment removal continues to be important. Mm-hmm. Don't be that guy. Exactly. Because we don't want you to be that guy.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, do you have anything else that you want to mention about this deck before we wrap things up?
Okay, yeah. Well, I had one thing I wanted to ask you about. There's really two cards that I thought I would want to try to play in this deck, or try to cram in. One of them was the need for, I felt my threats can kind of be variable. What do you think about Bloodbaron of Viscopa and Magister of Worth? These are the two cards that I thought if I was going to add a creature in, these would be it. So Magister of Worth, just so we'll cut out the nonsense. For white, black, you will of the council, you choose grace or condemnation. Basically, we're going to try to tie it up. I would choose condemnation, so it destroys everything, except Magister of Worth.
Yeah. Well, both these cards actually, I think, are pretty good for your deck.
Okay.
But it's a question of how many late game threats you really feel like you need. And if this were me, I think that we talked a little bit about the Wall of Reverence, Well of Lost Dreams combination. And if you don't expect artifact enchantment removal, that's one thing, because Well of Lost Dreams is great if you can use it and keep it in play for several turns and continue using it. Mm-hmm. If it's a situation where people are capable of removing it, then it tends to be a big waste of time. But if that is the situation, then I would default towards things that can attack. If people are capable of removing the working parts, I guess, for lack of a better term, of your deck, then yeah, just having a creature that comes into play and it clears the battlefield, I would favor that. Now, Blood Baron of Viscopa actually is very interesting to me, because it has this, rider text that tends to be very good in Commander, where if you have 30 or more life, it, does X, Y, or Z, and you see the same thing on Divinity of Pride. Blood Baron, though, also has two other abilities that are very relevant: protection from white and protection from black. The decks that you are lined up against, theoretically, have a lot of white in them. So that is going to be a very relevant protection ability. And obviously, protection from white and black gives you the ability to ignore most removal. If this becomes a 10-10, red removal also is essentially out. There's just, really, come on, how is that going to happen?
Yeah.
So I think Blood Baron, I'm not typically a fan of the card, but I think that you can set up a situation where lifelink is relevant, given the metagame you expect, protection from white and black are relevant, and given the fact that you're going to have a large life total, this will be a huge threat most of the time. I think that Blood Baron is probably worth finding space for somewhere in the deck.
Okay. So Magister of Worth, what are your thoughts on this? This is sort of, just trying to add in another one of the things I'm real bummed out about is that I had to cut Angel of Despair. Angel of Despair was just a freaking house in stack. It was so good. Being able to reanimate, with my one or two reanimate spells, being able to get a blink effect on it. I wanted something like that, so I added Sunblast Angel. But I also want to have another one, and I feel like Magister of Worth would be really solid. Do you think that this is worth it?
I do. Well, okay. I will pardon your pun,
yeah,
which was just blatant and horrible.
I wasn't trying to be. I mean, I didn't even think
about
it.
That's where you say no pun intended, and I still don't forgive you.
No, because if I say no pun intended, then the pun was intended.
Clearly,
this
yeah.
is like a you're, Seinfeld episode. Don't get there.
Anyway, I do think this card is actually very good, and I feel like the only reason that this card is available in a 2DH style format is the fact that white-black, specifically as a color identity, not very highly played in Commander at large. There's a lot of incentive to go Esper or to go white-black-green if you expand out to regular Commander. So that has helped keep the price of this down a little bit, even though it's really only playable in Commander. This card is very powerful in just a generic game of Magic. Being able to play this and say, yeah, we're going to kill all your things and I'm going to be left with a 4/4 flyer for 6 mana, that's very strong. And that will go a long way towards winning most games of Magic. Combining that with, what limited counterspells you have available in white, but you really probably only need one, plus maybe something like Cloud Shift to protect it once or twice. But, you swipe their board. You have a creature that can attack for large chunks of damage while subsequently you're gaining life and draining them with Obsidian. That's a realistic game plan that I feel like can, win given the competition you're expecting. I think Magister of Worth is, again, worth the inclusion.
Okay, awesome. I'm probably going to just, do exactly what you said. So the last question I have is, out of all the cards I have sitting here on the maybe board, that excluding Blood Baron and, the aforementioned Worth It Magister of Worth, what card do you think is most likely, or what card do you think I should have and don't have in my deck, and why? Obviously, Exsanguinate too. We talked about that a little bit.
There's a couple that I'm surprised
so just
aren't about. In there. Blind Obedience, we mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Blind Obedience is just really good. And it's good against those attack first decks that you're worried about seeing. Making creatures come into play tapped is a big deal. particularly if you're trying to race. And with a general that allows you to drain life, racing becomes a realistic possibility no matter where you are in the game. You can really affect the combat map. So Blind Obedience would be something that I want to try and stick in there.
Okay.
Dawn Charm?
Yeah.
Well, instead of something like Batwing Broom, like the other fog effects that you have, I feel like Dawn Charm just adds more flexibility because it can counter removal spells or counter things that are coming at your face. So it just sort of expands the possibilities for a card in that slot that you feel like you need.
Yeah.
You know, you have Faith Reward listed here. There's not a whole lot of synergy in your deck with Faith's Reward, but the card is extremely powerful, and if you wanted to sort of alter the landscape of your deck, you could make Faith's Reward into a key card. Draw's Verdict is something I always want to cram into my commander decks, but never seems to make the cut.
Yeah.
It's good value, and given that you've talked about people playing low land counts, they're going to be disincentivized to discard their lands to this, so you can pretty much guarantee that Draw's Verdict is going to be getting relevant cards most of the time. And that's good. And, you know, you can say the same thing about him to Turok. There's probably not a good argument, in my opinion, for not playing him to Turok in this deck. It's just an absurdly strong card. And right now it's at $2.06 on TCG. So maybe that's
cheapest,
that fluctuation.
Cheapest available, is not. Cause, you know, like we have a kind of a range. So, but yeah, because of how many copies there are in, Fallen Empires, we're in there.
Yeah, it could potentially be on either side of the line, given, you know, what happens in Legacy that week at the TCG Player Open or whatever. The last card I would say is Murderous Cut. Murderous Cut is just it's a premium removal spell, and if you're playing Condemn because you need good one mana removal, Murderous Cut typically is that one mana removal, and it's, you know, it's a really strong card. I think that most black decks should be playing it in Commander, and I think it's just fantastic. It's played in a lot of different formats because of its power level and its low mana cost.
One of the biggest challenges to playing Murderous Cut, and I keep having to take it out of my deck, tell myself to take it out, is because I want to have consistency with my removal spells. Like, I don't want to have something that's going to say destroy to make me forget that I don't have destroy. Like, a lot of things, like, I think the only thing that says destroy are, like, an artifact enchantment and wrath effects. I want to be able to exile as many creatures as I can, or at least stop them. And that's one of the reasons it hasn't come in here. But it's sitting here on the maybe board, and I want to get it in bad. This Massacre was in here just basically because I thought it would be meta tech. Massacre is a 2-cost double black. If an opponent controls a plains and you control a swamp, you may cast Massacre without paying its mana cost. All creatures get -2/-2 until end of turn. So the idea was just essentially hurt the Tajik and the Zergo decks. But I don't think that that's necessarily as good. Oh, and even the Narsa deck. But I don't think that that's necessarily as good. I don't want to be able to have to play this potentially against, you know, or hard cast this card in my deck. It's just going to be a dead card otherwise. So I'm just Magister of Worth is just plain more worth it.
Yeah. Well, Massacre is very, like you said, it's very good against particular decks, but it's less relevant against others. And if you have a wider scope in terms of the expected metagame, something like Massacre can be harder to justify in terms of slot. Now, it can be a situational Wrath of God, which is very, very good. But in the list of 7 other decks that you gave me, there really doesn't seem to be a true swarm deck among them. And people typically would think of Massacre as an anti-token card or an anti-swarm deck. People who want to get wide with their board.
The closest thing is the red aggro deck with, you know, that plays 1 and 2 drops. Basically, but even then it's not as good.
Yeah, then you still have to pay the full 4.
So the last card I think I want to talk about before we, you know, close this episode out is Dark Petition. So do you think this card is worth it in this deck? Do you think I should be playing it? Is there a case for it?
I think that you should be playing it in this deck, actually. I didn't want to mention it before because I thought there was just sort of a mute ban, if you will, on like playing tutors, because you don't have a whole lot of tutors, and it doesn't seem like the other decks aren't going to be doing a lot of tutoring. The Kagamara deck that you showed me as well. Like, I'm of the mind that I want to be tutoring for everything all the time, but that doesn't seem to be the case in this particular metagame. So I just assumed that it's sort of a social call. We're not going to be doing a lot of tutoring because there's plenty of tutor cards you can play. I think the card is good, and I think if tutoring is available, you should be doing as much of it as they'll allow you to. That includes five mana tutors if you have to play it like that. You know, that's uncomfortable for me, but in a format where you can't have the actual demonic tutor, you're gonna have to work with what you've got. And I think Dark Petition gets it done most of the time.
Well, the one slot that I have reserved for tutor was Increasing Ambition. That's my like go-to tutor. Like if I don't have demonic tutor, if I don't have these, you know, if I have to pick one, it's Increasing Ambition, just period. I think it's the best one that they've made since demonic tutor or, you know, vampiric, and they were crazy with stuff like that. I really like it. Dark Petition though, I can see a really good case for it. I have a dismember, I have an unmake. These are sweet, sweet rips with it. Before, I don't think I had that kind of situation. And in general, most of the deck, I don't think I really have a good case other than those two cards to go get anything. So it would basically be those two cards that I would be going to get ideally.
Well, also, it has some, I guess, some outside playability with other effects that, like, if you committed more directly to playing duress, like a large suite of duress effects, and you can guarantee to yourself that I will have spell mastery at, you know, basically any point into the game, it becomes a lot easier to justify playing this. So unless you want to, I feel like these cards almost come as a package, is sort of what I'm saying. If you're going to play three or four more duress style effects, you know, one mana discard effects, or something like Gerard's Verdict and Hymn to Turok, things that will put cards into your graveyard early that are sorceries and instants, then, you know, it starts to look better. But if you want to go a different direction, then I could very easily see it leaving it out as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that transitions well, really, Dark Petition into the other deck list. Would you like to talk about that one?
I actually don't think I have time, man.
Okay, no problem. So anyway, there's another list we're going to put in the show notes. I think that one would probably be better in the Kagamaro deck, I think, because that's where I'm doing what you're talking about. So mm-hmm. I'm probably going to try it out there, because I think that there's just plenty of stuff that I have, you know, planned for that deck, and that gives me ways to plan. Alrighty, well, we're going to go ahead and close it up for this episode of The Stack. Do you have any final thoughts, Chris?
I do not.
All right, so if you guys want to reach us, we were going to put our contact stuff in the show notes. We have a bunch of stuff also in the show notes, as always, for you guys to peruse and check out. And hopefully, by the time you guys see this episode, I'll have at least done pretty well with this Obsidian deck. You guys have some comments for it. I'm going to continue to play it. So, you know, it's always going to be in the air in rotation. So if you guys have comments, feel free to put them there on Tapped Out, or put them in the comments below on our podcast episode. Thanks for listening. Good evening, Vietnam, or whatever we say.
Oh boy.
Yep, that's how we end episodes. We don't really end them. They just kind of fade off into the funk city.